From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. A dream come true. Sitting across from me is someone I like to think is being an old friend, because I met him, gosh, 20 years ago, recording a piece for public television here in Southern California. Composer, bon vivant, and now the educator in a masterclass, Danny Elfman. First of all, Danny, so good to have you here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I guess I would ask you to explain for those of us who don't really know, didn't know about the masterclass until I heard about this, what exactly it is, how you describe it.
Well, I mean, God, I'm thinking of how to describe it. It's online, and they just have a lot of really good people really going into depth about what they do and how they do it. So, you know, you got Annie Leibovitz talking about how she sets up a session, how she approaches photography, how her whole attitude about the whole thing. You've got David Lynch, you know, kind of going on like the total opposite side of like just pure David Lynchian wonderful craziness. And then, so it can be very technical, it could be very theoretical, but everybody just approaches it how they approach their art. And I thought of doing it because in the last 5-10 years, I started doing more, because I started performing with this Elfman Burton show and, you know, going out into other cities in something I hadn't done any of that in such a long time. And I started kind of, well, can you go to the university, talk with some film music students, music students? And I started doing that, and I found I was really enjoying it. And I thought about it, and I said, God, I'd have killed to have access to seeing Bernard Herrmann scoring, talking about how he scored, or Jerry Goldsmith.
Or Franz Waxman, or Steiner. Who also mentioned in this piece.
Absolutely. So I thought, well, why not? You know, it's like I enjoy talking about it. And I think my approach to scoring and composing is different enough than other composers that maybe a young person who's starting out, it would be helpful for them getting a different perspective than what they might be taught at school.
Sure, because one of the things you say in this masterclass that I thought was really telling, and I think it will help a lot of people, is that you say, I had no mentor. Which I think is a really interesting thing for people to hear, because what it gets to the grander point in your masterclass, which is really to listen to yourself.
Right, exactly. I had no mentor and I had no training. So, you know, everything I've done, I've just done with my own sensibility and teaching myself, you know, self-taught. But because of that, and because, as I said in the class, I've got a very chaotic brain, I don't have an organized mind at all. So I've had to develop my own way to be able to figure out how to systematically do anything, because it's like real chaos in there most of the time. And so I thought that could be helpful too, because I said to myself, I'll bet there's a lot of artists out there like myself who are not organized people. I mean, look, some people are lucky and they've got the minds of engineers and they could like really break something down and get analytical about it and put it all in a certain perspective, but not me. You know, for me, it's like grabbing stuff out of a tornado and trying to get hold of it as it's swirling by. So I thought, I know other artists must also have chaotic minds like mine, and maybe they can get something out of this. You know, what is it like when you don't have your together and you approach going at something that's really requires a lot of discipline?
You just described my life, Danny. But I think what you do that I think is really fascinating, and it shows for I think people who don't know you that well how complete your grasp is of the medium, is you talk about films being a medium that was kind of derided and not taken seriously. But it's become that. But the real language of film, as much as the filmmaking itself, is the music, which in fact is older than dialogue.
Right.
I mean, music goes back to the beginning of a film.
Right.
And for you to sort of say that, basically talk about a medium that composing, not taken seriously by the people making the films, that was really interesting the way you sort of, you offer both a historical perspective and your own perspective in being involved in all this. And I wondered how long it took you to arrive at the way you really lay out a narrative.
Well, I mean, the historical side, you know, I'm a lousy historian, so I talk about things historically, but I'm often wrong, you know.
But like, you write about film being this.
Well, I'll get the dates wrong and, you know, I'll mix things up. But I studied in the sense that I was a fan. So I approached coming into film scoring as a fan, and I've often described it as like, what if Jack Nicholson at the Lakers game, where he sat courtside for so many years, suddenly somebody got injured and they threw him the ball and said, Jack, you're on the court now. And I said, that's kind of how I felt when I got my first film.
Except we should say, and I want to, and this is really key to all this, you mentioned this in this piece, but I'm glad you did. You've always been a storyteller, and you understand music is a medium that's a narrative structure too. And it's important to bring that kind of narrative construct, either to offer a straight line or to comment on the chaos going on in the film.
Right. I personally am a believer in the musical narrative, and that can express itself in so many ways. I mean, there's obviously the classical way, like the way you're talking about Max Steiner and Korngold and you know, the great original composers. They were post-romantic composers from Europe, and they understood narrative writing, even though film didn't really exist when they started composing.
But to that point about history, you make the point about Steiner and King Kong, integral that was to...
Well, I mean, post-romantic music is narrative. When I'll tell you a story that explains how I feel about it. I mean, first off, it was even going back to Fantasia, putting Stravinsky to the dinosaurs. I mean, there was a narrative there. Now, of course, he wasn't imagining dinosaurs, but everybody comes up with their own narrative. It's such expressive narrative music. I was driving home. I lived in Topanga Canyon, and I was going up the canyon listening to the classical musical station, and they were playing a piece of music that I didn't recognize, and they sometimes played film music, but it sounded so film to me. I had to know who wrote this music. It was killing me because it was so good. It was so beautiful, but it sounded so narrative. I was imagining what kind of scene this was going to. And I also made a commitment to myself that if it was one of my contemporaries, I was retiring right then and there on the spot. Because I'll say, I could never do this. And if this is one of my own, you know, contemporaries, I'm out of here. I'm finished. Fortunately, it was a symphony by Shostakovich, and I sat outside my house for about 10 minutes waiting for the back announcement, you know, and it was like, I was so relieved. But the point being is that it was movie music. It was classical music. And
so really, is Prokofiev, who you mentioned in this piece as
Prokofiev,
well.
Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, I mean, so many, really from the late 19th century. And the whole point is, historically, is that they came up with this new medium of film. It starts silent. It's the beginning of the 20th century. So we're in the 20s and you're playing piano to a film. They're just kind of putting some music. Now it's the 30s. And so you look at the first Frankenstein movie, no score. The first Dracula movie, no score. And the idea of score was just like a little music when the curtain goes up and when the curtain comes down. And suddenly, somewhere around 33, 34, they get the idea, you know what? We can synchronize music to picture. What do we do? There was no template. There was no, how do we do this? So they brought these great composers over from Europe, Steiner, Korngold, Waxman, and said, look, you guys know what to do. Apply it to film. And the beauty of what they did is there was nothing for them to learn. How do we do what we know to do for concert music and make it work for narrative for film? And they did. And so I look at the scores to King Kong and The Bride of Frankenstein, which were amongst the first scores, really full scores to film. And they still hold up beautifully today. They're beautiful, evocative narrative scores. Now, of course, things have changed over the years. And I try to talk about this. There's so many ways to approach it. That's the classical way. You can also do it with just synthesizers, with sounds. You know, there's just so many ways to do it now, and depends on the style of the film. But ideally, the film is still giving you a narrative feeling of it's taking you through, it's telling you the story, and it's either directing you or misdirecting you as needed, because it's just as likely to be either. And the music can do both really well. It can take you to a certain place emotionally, or it could lead you away because the director doesn't want you to be prepared for what's about to happen. And the music can mislead you, misdirect. So when something happens, it happens with a bigger surprise.
It's the treat. My guest reminded me by using the word back announce, so I should say what we're doing. It's the treat. My guest is Danny Elfman, who has, in addition to doing so many terrific things in his career, is doing a master class now. And I guess one of the things I want to get to is that your background in storytelling. I mean, we go back to the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. That was a night that began with a narrative. I mean, your entire, go back and listen to the albums. They're basically all sort of compositional pieces that begin and end and have a climax before they get to the end. So you've always worked in narrative. So when you finally moved into film music, it must have felt like this you were offered a bridge to do something that's so close to where you'd already been living.
Well, it's kind of complicated because you said the Mystic Knights. Now, the Mystic Knights was a theater troupe. We didn't do any contemporary music. And in that, I was starting to write, and I taught myself to write music in the Mystic Knights. But mainly, we were doing a lot of early 1930s stuff and then originals. So, like, I actually taught myself to write music doing Duke Ellington transcriptions. So I kind of learned from Ellington the basics of how to take a piece of music and write it on paper.
Which is also giving you the kind of the perfect American thing because it's orchestral with a count.
With a count. And by the way, you know, his jazz music with his small orchestra got very narrative and expressive.
Oh, completely. Yes.
In a really unique way. And then I started a band. And I figured, oh my God, all that work I did with the Mystic Knights was now down the drain. Because, you know.
That's really what you thought.
Oh, yeah. Because you never have to write any music. All that time I spent trying to learn how to notate, transcribe, and notate music. I wrote the last piece of music I wrote for the Mystic Knights was called Oingo Boingo Piano Concerto No. 1½. And it was kind of inspired by both Prokofiev and Stravinsky and just craziness. But it was an actual composition that was about 4½ minutes long for a 10-piece orchestra. And later, when my first film happened with Pee Wee's Big Adventure, I had to try to go, all right, how did I write that down? Because that's the first time I wrote a completely original piece of music on paper from top to bottom from multiple pieces. Because I first panicked. I said, I don't know how to write for a whole orchestra. And then I realized, well, wait a minute. Writing for orchestra is still writing for sections. If you have 70-piece orchestra, you're not writing 70 individual parts. I mean, you know, you've got your strings, you've got your brass, you've got your woodwinds. And I realized, you know what? It's not that different. I'm still writing 12 parts down for this particular piece. And I had to go back in time. But, you know, when I was with Oingo Boingo, the band, and that's why this is such a messy story, because the same name, two completely different ensembles. So I like to say the Mystic Knights. That was like 8 years of my life was doing this theater. Then Oingo Boingo, you don't write anything down. You pick up an electric guitar and you just start playing pieces. And so I thought it was all wasted. And then in 1985, Tim comes along with Pee Wee's Big Adventure. And I'm going, oh, crap. I got to write everything down. How do I do that? I barely knew how to do it in the first place and I'd practically forgotten. So I had to go back to where I was and like, remember, how did you write down that little concerto?
But what he saw and what you were doing in both these iterations is that there was a sense of narrative momentum that you were always bent on making happen.
There was always some kind of narrative. But I was also, as I was saying, I was a fan of early film music. So from the age of 12, when I heard Bernard Herrmann's score to The Day the Earth Stood Still, I was like, oh my God, film music isn't just there automatically. Like, you know, as a kid, you don't think about it, right? It's just there. And suddenly, no, it's not just there. There's a name. And every time I saw this name, I knew something extra was going to be in the film because I grew up on those great fantasy films of Herrmann's and The Day the Earth Stood Still was the first, but The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts.
I'm going to ask you to take what we call in the musical business a pause. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more Danny Elfman. It's The Treatment. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. Before I get ahead of myself, it's a treatment. I'm so excited to be talking to our old friend Danny Elfman, who, in addition to his storied and spectacular career, has also now done a master class. But there had always been that sense of not only just narrative, but momentum. And we're talking about momentum, which comes from all those Russian composers and Waxman and Steiner, who you loved.
And Herman.
And Herman. And but also, interestingly, in a genre of film that had been kind of disregarded during that period. Mm-hmm. But these guys were doing scores that were not throwaway pieces, but were there in the masterclass. You illustrate by having some of the Beast of Five Fingers and talking about what that did to you. In fact, it being so impactful that the five-finger motif still lives on in your life.
Yeah, it's funny because just a couple of weeks ago, I saw Ray Chan, a violinist, playing at Disney Hall, and he was playing the Bach piece that inspired the score to the Beast of the Five Fingers, because in that, the cut-off hand, the amputated hand, actually plays this piece of Bach. And I said, look, I know this sounds crazy, but this piece of music has been in my head since I was 6 years old, kind of obsessively, because it's always been played by an amputated hand. And he looked at me and he was like, okay, I think I understand. Or this guy is like completely crazy. But yeah, it did kind of start with The Beast with Five Fingers, Peter Lorre, when I was six.
But all these films, and also, I'm glad you brought it, because I was going to mention Peter Lorre. I mean, that anxiety, and you talk about being such a fan of Peter Lorre, there's the kind of a sense of anxiety that powers a lot of your music, you know, and as you play various pieces in the masterclass of these scores, you can hear a little bit of that underpinning of that anxiety. And I wonder if that even goes back to what Peter Lorre brought to the films as an actor.
Oh, probably. I mean, look, all these things affect us, no matter, even if we don't know it. So, I mean, no one's ever said that to me before, but you're saying it for the first time, and it makes complete sense to me.
Really, no one's ever said that to you before?
No. And it's like, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why I connected with his personality, that angst, that anxiety that he carried, you know. And when I first met Tim Burton, I mean, we thought it was funny that his idol was Vincent Price and mine was Peter Lorre. And it kind of defined our next 35 years of our relationship, because Vincent Price was often torturing Peter Lorre in one way or another, because Peter Lorre was always the tortured character and Vincent Price was always the master.
That's so funny, because when you mentioned that in the masterclass, I thought it was to explain, because I just thought, and it actually went, and you were so generous a few years ago to give me that beautiful box of your scores and that incredible container. I went back and played them. I thought, yeah, there's that sort of sense of playfulness and unease that exists in complementary terms, not contradictory terms, that inform a lot of your film scoring.
Well, I mean, it just informs my personality, you know, anxiety, angst, and ridiculousness all mixed together in an absurd brew.
But I want to get back to what we said in the first half was about listening to yourself, because you talk at some point about talking to directors and your preference as a filmmaker who is not expert or a composer or trained at Juilliard, as you put it, just because in a lot of ways they tend to be more direct about what it is they want. They're not trying to say things. They're just telling you what it is they need, and they can offer you a way in a way that somebody who's being more specific cannot.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I found that, you know, the directors who have musical knowledge, who try to talk musically, you end up usually going down a path that you'll end up changing, and because it's not really what they mean. It's just what they're thinking at that moment. It all comes down to emotionally, and I'll always encourage them just to say, how do you feel about the scene? It's like, that's all that matters. I mean, because there's no way you can really describe a piece of music any more than you could describe a piece of art. If you're describing a painting to an artist, I want a painting. It should be abstract, but it should feel like this. You can't really, no matter what you do, it's not going to be what the person's thinking in their brain. So, you know, you've got to like get into their heads and try to find a way to fine tune what you're doing to hit that spot for them until they finally go, yeah, that's what's working for me. And you never know what that's going to be. Every director is completely different. And inside of their heads, talk about chaos. I mean, it could be pretty chaotic in there too when you get in a director's brain. And especially at the end when they're finishing a movie. Remember, composers are the last part of a film. We're at the very end. By the time we come on a film, a director has probably been working maybe a year, 2 years or more on this film. They've been running it in their mind. You're there for the last 3 months before it's all done. We're the caboose at the end of the train. So we're getting them at their most anxious, because most directors tend to start really confidently, You know, of course, they have to. They have to have this great belief in themselves and the material. And at the end, most directors are not quite as sure. Now they've shot the film and they're putting it together, and a lot of it is going to be just as they imagine, and some of it's going to happen spontaneously, and now they're feeling their way through it. They're finding it, you know, unless they're like Alfred Hitchcock, that they literally draw out, storyboard every single frame, and by the time they're shooting, they're just really, the work's already done. Most directors don't work that way. They're finding their film still in the edit at the end. And now they're being forced by the studio to preview their film in front of an audience. And now they're getting reactions that are totally unexpected. And I can't even imagine. Talk about angst. What directors go through at the end is really brutal frequently. And we're there for that. We're like their lieutenant, right, at the end of a big, long war. And it gets crazy. That's all I could say. It could be really insane.
God, there's so much to talk about with my guest, Danny Elfman. It's a treatment, by the way. I'm talking about this masterclass. But a couple of things. First of all, in the masterclass, you say you're basically asking somebody to describe something that doesn't exist. So it's even different than talking about a painting. You're trying to describe something for you that has yet to be composed, literally.
Right.
But also, as we were talking about this, and you mentioned that's this the case, the composers are last to come on. If it was ever a desire you harbor to have the kind of relationship that Sergio Leone had with Morricone,
yeah.
where Capone not only composed but recorded the scores before the movie was shot.
Yeah, I would love to do that someday. I mean, that's just a whole different thing, you know, like taking it into the conceptual level early on. I'm working with the director Joe Wright right now, and Joe has actually frequently worked that way in the past, where, you know, he's gotten music in advance and thought of that. But, you know, we got together late in the project. So, you know, that is one of the most fantastic cinema relationships, Sergio Leone and Morricone, and how they work together. So, of course, I dream of that. You know, I dream of these incredible ways of working that produce such amazing work.
Before we go too far from this, you said that thing, and it really just struck a bell with me, that the director is trying to describe something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
When did that occur to you, that concept? Because that's exactly what it is. Was it early on you realized they're trying to get their arms around something that hasn't even been fashioned yet?
Well, I mean, that's just from the beginning. It was like, that's what you do. You know, when I came on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, it's like Tim didn't even tell me, you know, he couldn't tell me what kind of music he wanted. He just showed me the film. And I just went out there and said, I'm just going to have fun with this. I don't care. You know, it's like the score will probably get thrown out anyhow. And then they'll hire a real composer to do like a proper score. So that was my attitude when I started. It's like, I'm just going to enjoy this. I'm just going to have fun with the experience. And then they'll throw it out, but I'll still have the experience. So in hindsight, it was a good way to approach.
Because what you're talking about, the great composers, Waxman and Steiner and Herman, were the relationships, these are composers with relationships, I mean to say. Herman with Hitchcock, but these other composers with the studios. So they knew they had a relationship with places, and they understood musically what the studios wanted from the film. And you've been lucky in that you've had long relationships as a composer, which must offer an enormous amount of just having that relationship must make things, I didn't want to say easier because it's not easier.
It doesn't make it easier. That's the
But a relationship gives you definition, I guess I mean to say.
Well, it's true because what you said was absolutely correct. In the old days, they worked for the studios. Now, it was much clearer for them. The studio would say, you know what to do. The director wasn't even involved. And they knew that this composer will write this kind of score and they could depend on it. And they're just going to do what they need to do and get it out there. Since the 70s, since that all changed, it became about the director. It's gotten much more complicated because the studio doesn't tell you what kind of score to write. The director really wants you to come into their world and they want to express it their own way. And it's a much more personal experience than it would have been back in those days. It's just a whole different animal. And the directors, you know, sometimes are looking for something that's ephemeral, something that I don't know what it is, but I'll know it when I hear it. That's basically the way Tim works. I mean, the way Tim and I have worked for 17 films now, it's like he won't ever tell me what kind of music to write. He never did. Never. He would never do that. He barely tells me anything about the film. He's not going to respond until there's music to hear. So when we sit down to look at a film, it's called a spotting session. I mean, we're just running the film saying music starts, music stops. music starts, music stops. That's it. And giving the cues numbers so we just know how much of a score there is. That's all we talk about. And we've learned, both of us, that to talk about it further is pointless. He might tell me emotionally, this scene, I'm concerned about this. This scene, I want to make sure that we play this quietly or we really play this strong. You know, he might have a couple notes about a couple moments where he has feelings about it. Other than that, it's not until I start playing music back that he'll either be pulling his hair out or he'll start to be kind of nodding his head. And that's how I know. It's all body language. You know, it's like inevitably the most terrifying thing for a composer of film is playing music back for the first time. Because no matter what you play, it's not what the director is imagining. There's just no way it's going to be what they're imagining. It's just not going to be. They've got something in their head and you're doing something different. And you're watching their face and you're trying to act calm, but you know, I'm sweating. And it's like, I'm trying to get some body language. It's like, is there a nodding going on or is there an anxious look? Like with Tim, is he pulling his hair? Oh, that's a bad sign.
He's literally pulling his hair.
Yeah, he'll be like kind of pulling his hair. It's that's bad. That's really bad. And you're just looking at their faces and like waiting for that first response, because it's either going to be like, well, that was really interesting, Danny, but... And then it's like, here's where you're off the mark. And like, I understand why you did what you did, but here's why it's not working for me. Or you get there's a pause and you go, that was really cool. And you're just like trying not to jump up and down and go crazy. What's weird is that I've done it 100, 105 times and nothing has changed. Playing it for the director the first time is the most sweaty, palmed experience of my life that I can imagine.
You ever had one experience where you've done the score and you go, this is it. I know I nailed this one. This is going to be the way this goes.
No, because I may feel that and the director will go, no, it just doesn't work for me. And I have to let it go. So early on, no matter what I think of a piece of music, I can't get attached to it yet. Because if I do, I'm screwed. Because it just happens in films where you have to totally change direction, where sometimes the first music I play for a director is going to learn, he is going to learn or she is going to learn why and what it is they're not responding to. And that will lead me to something else that they will respond to. So it's a process. And sometimes it's bingo from the get-go. It's like a jackpot. And sometimes you have to circle around, and then finally you get there. And then suddenly it's like, yeah, that's it. But it's like a circular path and a lot of work to get to that place. You just never know.
Which score of yours really is the most emotional thing to listen to? I'm not going to ask you about what's best, but when you hear, you kind of go, it just takes you right back to where you were.
Well, I mean, my listening to my own music is a different experience than anybody else. I'm remembering the experience. Uh-huh. So I'll remember, damn, that was hard. That was really, I can't say it. I got to watch my language.
That's okay. You swore enough for one show. We're out of time. You got to come back. Please, you have to come back and do this again.
I'd love to.
My guest is Danny Elfman. He's got a masterclass. Go check it out where masterclasses are found. I guess it's masterclass.com. Find that out. Recording engineer who doesn't know, is Marcia Caldwell here at NPR West. The show is mixed and edited by Kat Yor, who probably knows everything. I know nothing. It's the treatment. To catch up on past episodes of the treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.